accession number 18361, Reel 2.
Mr. Novak, Reel 2.
Yes. We left everything, what was in the farm, even clothing we were not allowed to take any more than we could wear. And all he said to my father, all you can take an axe, saw, fork, if you can, that you may need, because you'll be working, and that's all. Won't take. So father didn't take anything, not even axe, anything. He said, father said, if I take that, they might think I'm going to kill them or something. So he left it. Never take anything. It put us on the sleigh, and it was cold. The moon was so nearly setting. I can see it now, big as anything, and the frost was absolutely about 15 to 20 degrees. That was that cold. They put us on a sleigh, all the lot, and off we went to place. To the railway station, which was not very far from my mom when she was born. Lubomirka, it was called. Took us there, and there was people. They took us to Rubne, because it was nearer, but they didn't. They took us about another 10 kilometers further down, up the railway line. And when they brought us there, there was people, hundreds, thousands, I don't know, there was absolutely two trains was waiting, and they put us in the cattle trucks with already made bunk beds. The railway truck, that's Polish trucks were smaller than Russians. There was a bunk, one bunk, and two bunks on each side, and the doors open across. There was only one fireplace in the middle, and a toilet utilities. You know, there was a hole cut in the floor, and that was all. Nothing else. Not even log of fire to make fire in the stove. Anything. There was nothing. People had to go and fend for themselves. And they took us from Lubomirka to Rubne and to Zdolbunov, and then we translated from Polish railway to the Russian one, because that was the changing point. That's why the German bombed it, I suppose. And it took us now the quite very big trucks. They pack up people like sardines. They were there. And where the misery started then. That was the 10th of February they took us away. On the 11th of February we have been in Zdolbunov, and that was the our journey went up to Kotlas from there.
What was the journey like?
Nothing. It was terrible. There was no food. They didn't give any food or anything. Nothing. There was full of guards then. The guards were on every truck. Every truck had his own guard. And he only opened the doors to have hot water, to take hot water on the stations where they decided to stop. And they give you 300 grams of bread with the water. And that's all, nothing else. And that's where they started to pile up, because that was February and March. Somewhere in March we went to a place called Kotlas again. So full of people already before us. There was place called Kotlas.
Did any incidents happen on the journey?
No, not far as I know. I remember, recall any incidents that didn't happen. The incidents happened after, when the people got very weak and they started to die and diseases and all that. And they, from Kotlas, they took us to another 20 kilometers, a place called Privodino, on the sleigh. There was hundreds, I don't know where they got all those horses and sleighs from to carry the people, but only the children and the women, the people who couldn't walk, But the rest of us who was fit to walk, we had to walk. And it was in the middle of the Russian winter, really, March. We had to walk, and we had to go to a place called Privodino. We arrived there, then they gave us a meal, we had a meal then in a canteen then.
Had you taken any food with you?
No, they did not. Whoever had the food, but mom was caught without having enough bread. You see, that is the point, that Mr. Finkelguss, he would tell the father, I said, between the lines, make enough bread, you know, didn't have to tell anything in details, really. But he didn't say anything. He was dealing with father, and he still owes money, really, because he was buying things and he didn't pay, and he was paid now on the book. He got almost buy a cow or horse or corn, you know, you pay some, but the rest of it we buy in the goods, you know, they keep the books. And that sort of thing, part exchange. But I think he still owe father for about 10 or 20 pounds now. But that's life.
What was there at Privodino?
Privodino, that was Les Promhos. That's the forestry. Les Promhos is the factory or transfer. Promhos, I knew the word in English, but it just didn't come to me. Now, they've been producing the wood to the material, you know, the industry, the bark, the wood, and cut the planks and make mostly railway sleepers.
A timber mill,
that's it. Yeah, that's a timber mill. That was big, about 5 kilometers long. It was on the river Dvina. That was. Oh, people work in the forest. They took us to the forest about another 30 kilometers inside the taiga, inside the forest wood. And there was a snow, 2 meters high. Somebody jumped from the train in the snow. He was up to his neck, really, the snow. Yeah. And there was already huts there, the timber logs, buildings, empty and filthy and smelly and all this. And they packed all the people in those huts. So we had 3 days free. And then went and sent us to work in cutting woods.
Did you have to work?
Oh, yes.
What work were you doing?
First of all, they sorted out. The young people was working separate from the old people. Old people were working somewhere else, and the young people was working separate, cutting timber. So the Russians were... They cut the wood, felled the wood feathers, and we had to go and pick up branches and burn the branches and all things like that. It was hard work walking on the snow. There was nothing to eat. You got every day went by, one got weaker and weaker and weaker, and they called it produce the norms. The norms, the Russians, they've been making fortune, really. They're those who fell the timber, because they cut the timber and they sorted it out for sleepers and building materials and firewood. And those people, like young like me and other lot of people, my friends, they were getting nothing. We couldn't make enough money to buy 300 grams of bread and the soup. There was not enough money, no more than a ruble a day for 12 hours work. And the soup cost 1 ruble and 5 kopeyek. I don't remember how much bread cost. There was not enough.
So how did you cut the wood?
We didn't cut the wood. We pick up branches as what cut wood was ready, fallen down. What the Russians, they went ahead cutting wood. We were behind them to pick up branches and sorted it out. It was another Russian with us that sorted out. But after that, you see, all that couple of weeks later on, they sort you out. And they will tell you, oh, he's all right, this one is all right. They give you sort of thing, better encouragement. That's why the young people didn't work with the old people, so they wouldn't be influenced.
So you picked up the branches and then burnt them?
Burned them, yes.
Why didn't they just leave the branches?
Because the forest wood, for fire safety. You see, they've been cutting, say 1 kilometer forest, like from here to London, probably further. So they cut squares, kilometer squares, and between each square, they have cut about 200 or 300 meters wide space. A kilometer long, or whatever it was, that was cleared up, and another square kilometer, and the squares, and those squares were after they in summertime they came with the big machines, you know, caterpillars and international. The caterpillars then, even then, I don't know where they got it from, but they had that. And they've been ripping roots out, root rippers and all that, and cultivated. And they've been planting corn on that places. The corn will grow in that 6 months' time period. The corn that grows for food.
And so if you weren't getting enough food, how could you cope with the work?
You tell me. I don't know how, but the work. Somehow, you see, if you work, make more norms and produce more, you see, they will pay you more. You see, and I was lucky in that respect, because nearly to the end of that work cutting wood, they were taking timbers out from the wood to the station. It was a narrow line station. I've been taking the wood from the forest, dragging it to the station, loaded on the trucks, and taking to the process plant, to Privodino, down that where they process the wood, sorted out, cutting planks and slippers and all that. And there was one Russian, you see, that was driving tractor, you see, and when he came in to pick up wood, well, I used to help putting up the slate, you know, steel plate, and they roll the timber on there with the big spikes on there, rolling timber on there, and there's a wire rope and go through the loop and tie it up and hook it up to tractor, and it tow it away. But I went and given a hand several times, and next time he came, he said, "You've been working with me." So I got a better job, really, by that. And it was all right. He said, end of April, this is spring coming in, you see, and they stopped cutting timber then, because all that was cut, they had to be taken away. So they transfer all the families, all the, how many families were there? I wouldn't like to say, well, 100, I reckon. They took us all the families from there, from the Kotovalsk, it was a place called, took to Privodino, and we stayed in that place to the time of release.
What kind of work was your father doing?
Our father was working in the blacksmith shop, then he got ill, got a pneumonia. Was father didn't enjoy very good health, and he was exempt from work after that, because he couldn't work, and he worked on somewhere, you know, given hand, you know, like was he was a blacksmith and engineer, so used to go and work in the blacksmith shop, give him a hand to the blacksmith, or do something in the electric station where they've been making electricity, the steam engines they've had. So he worked on that. And then after he went and worked in, when he got a bit better, he worked in Privodino in blacksmith shop making the brazing pipes for the steam engines, you know, this high drying steam, to dry steam, those pipes. And he was very good at that. So he was brazing all those pipes for the engine. So it was a bit better. But mostly, then, we got the parcels from Poland. They've been allowed to send the parcels.
With food?
With food, yes. Yeah. My auntie, she sent us a lot of parcels. And then I said they've been never touched. Everything what had they sent, I think it was 10 kilo, the maximum they could send. And every parcel came in, they was all intact. Only they had to open when they come with the commissar. Another story I will tell you now, this. The commandant of the camp will come and say, well, Gospodin Novak, he said, or Tavarish Novak, you've got a pachka come in. So we had to go with father and collect it. And they had to open there and in the post office, which is everything was there. We had to sign the ticket that has been received. So that, you know, and that sense, you know, they pretend to be quite honest in that way, because nothing was ever missing.
What was your mother doing? Working?
No, my mother had a young family, so she stayed at home. She was exempt from work because the children were, the youngest sister was, Amirka was 2 years old, I think, the youngest one, if I remember.
What was it like living in the wooden huts?
Oh, the lice. No, there's the wood lice. That is special, that pluskvi, what you call it. I don't know. I look at
bugs?
The dictionary. It's the name. Is it
bugs?
Bug, like a kind of a black beetle or something. Lice, and they live in the woods. In the wood. It's not pluskva. Do they mind if I look in the dictionary? And it,
well,
no, it doesn't
matter. I've heard other people mention it.
Yes, they were terrible because they hide in the crevices and you can't take them out, can't see anything. They suck the blood, whatever is left, and they leave a great red mark on that. But they've been disinfecting it, so I must say that they did care about a little bit of that hygiene. And they always take you once to the bath, once a week. Everybody had to go and have a banya, what they call it.
But did you have a space of your own, a place of your own, or was it like a barracks?
Oh, barracks, all communal, all in one. Everybody living in one place. No, nothing on your own.
Just Polish people?
Just Polish people, yes.
What did they tell you about the regime and the system in Russia?
Well, they always give, the commissar always come and give a lecture in the Krasny Gulag. You know, they chase the young people there. They had to go and listen, and they had to go social behavior, music, dance, or cinema, or whatever. The young people had to join.
Krasny
Ugolok.
What does it mean? Red?
Red corner.
What does it mean? A red corner?
Red corner, well, it's the Krasny Ugolok. You said that is the, like a hall.
A display?
No, that would be, well, in English would be the hall, public hall, not the village hall. That's what it really means, but what translates into English, but the Krasny Ugolok, that's red corner, exactly to translate, but it means more than that.
What was in the red corner?
Well, there was a little library and books. Of course, all for for how Russia and communism is excellent in this, what they achieved from Stalin, from Tsar to Stalin, how they transferred Russia in the, put them on the pedestal of the, in Europe. A certain amount is true, really, but the Tsar didn't care much about that. And then you got the films. They show you mostly propaganda films of how they conquered the war in Finland, when the tank had their mighty tanks pulling big trees down and all that. Well, it's all propaganda, really, but that's, you had to go to that and to see that. And they had a dance. They had to go to dance, social dances, and mixed with Russian people. More contact there was allowed. More contact then. That was in the from the first summer we spent in Privodino. But then, as time progressed, in many ways it was a bit easier. You see the people what had, like my mom, or they had some gold rings and earrings and all that. They changed that for food. You know, go in the villages, the man gives you, the commandant gives you permit. You will go in the village and buy something and change.
So she would barter her gold rings?
Gold
with
rings. Oh, anybody, yes, with the Russian. Whoever had any clothing, if any had any good clothing, you see, that could be changed as well. They changed it for food. But one of the things is the commandant of the camp, which is called, one called Rogachevsky, or the other one called Bayov, Commandant Bayov. And when I mentioned previously, my father was in Kiev in the army, in the Tsar army. That's unbelievable, but it's true. And there was a Sartoraya, or that means the shop where they modify clothing.
Tailors.
Yeah, tailors shop, yeah. And the Bayov, we call Bayovsky then. And my father recognized him. Father said he was about 14 years old when father was in Kiev serving the army. And that his father had a tailor shop. And nobody would believe it. Well, that is true. When father said to us, to mom, and said, "Do you know, I know that man." So he went and asked him, I said, "Do you come from Kiev?" He asked the commandant, he was Bayov. And he was Bayovsky, now he's Bayov. Boyev. And he said to him, "How do you know?" And he said, "Your father had a tailor shop opposite the barracks." And he said, "How do you know that?" He said, "Father said, because he was in the army there, and I went to transfer, to change my clothing, you know, the old soldiers do probably." And he said to father, "You know that, and you must not tell anybody a word about this."
Why?
I don't know. He was both of them, they were Jews, Boyev, because he was a tailor, and father, no, his father was a Jew. And Rogachevsky came from Belarus somewhere, but he was a nice man. But Bayov, and was another Plishkin, he was absolutely terror. Absolutely terror. He would come to the canteen, and if somebody was telling that you didn't work, well, he can take your soup away from you. That Plishkin, he was absolutely menace.
Was he an official?
Yes, he was a policeman or what I NKVD. No, that's the, you know, official, the highest rank, really.
So, did you have any rights in this place?
Only the rights, they say international rights. That's what they say. That's what you're entitled by international law. They keep telling us, but they telling us one thing, and what they were doing is quite opposite. Who do you want to complain about in international law?
Did they try to influence you to be communist?
Oh, yes. My goodness me, you got to play a game. You got to say one thing and mean the other. You got to say that that's the best system in the world, but... Well, I didn't know many systems then, but I knew very well one. Yes, oh yes, they influence to be. Only if you pretend to be a communist and praise the communism and all things, if one is fooling them enough, he will get better. But then, you see, one can fool for so long that probably on the end he would believe himself that it's true. So, somewhere had to be drawn a line. My mother was the one who said, you can't go any further than that. The children, the younger sister, she was 4 or 5 then, went to school and come home and say, well, mommy said, we prayed to Jesus and he didn't give us anything. But we prayed to Stalin and he gave us sweets. Let's say that's true. Yes.
How did you get the sweets?
The sister came and told mother, you see. And mom said, but don't you believe that? She soon put the things right. I said, that is all this. But what could mother say to the child? You see, if you pray to Jesus, didn't give you anything, and you pray to Stalin, you'll get a packet of sweets. So the child would say, it's better pray to Stalin than to Jesus, isn't it? No, it's obvious. The child's mind works like that. It's already poisoned. It's already influence of evil. It's easier to believe than believe the truth.
So you'd reached the summer of 1940.
What
happened to you in that summer?
Well, I work, there's another story, you see, I work on the sorting the timber, you know, the cutting the timber. So the gangs of or the groups of people, you know, again, only young, they were working on the, I was on the cutting the 1.5 meters timber from 10 centimeters thick, you see, for balan. And we got to cut this timber, and there was just two machines, two planing machines that had been cutting the timber, you know, taking the bark off. You see, the barking machines. So I work on that for that summer. And after that, you see, they didn't keep you very long, because if you work well, you know, if you behave yourself, one behave yourself, what could one do? You see, you got to dance to the music to a certain amount. You know, you may be dancing with the nail in your boot.